Hello and welcome to our third installment in our podcast Downtown Drash. My name is Dr. Michal Biton and I'm the Rosh Keila of the Downtown Minyan. I'm here with my podcast co-host and colleague Rabbi Joe Wolfson, JLIC Rabbi at the Bronfman Center of New York University. We are really thrilled to be starting this podcast and hope you will join us on a weekly basis. Although usually we focus on the parasha of the week, this coming Shabbat is Shabbat Chol HaMoed in the middle of Pesach, which technically does not have a parasha. So we decided to spend some time discussing some big questions and ideas from the Haggadah of the Seder instead. We'll get into some deep questions about that the Haggadah brings up for us and end with one idea that we each think is a powerful message that Pesach can teach us for this year when we're celebrating our holiday under quarantine. So, you know, before we jump into the big questions that we have about Pesach and the Haggadah, Rabbi Joe, how do you conceptualize what the Haggadah is supposed to be for us?
Well, I can't remember if I made this up or if I heard this somewhere, but the loveliest metaphor that I ever heard for the Haggadah, which is the text of the story that we tell on the first and second night of Pesach, is that it's a script. It's the script of a play. It's the play of the story of the Jews leaving Egypt. And if you think about that metaphor, a script, in order to come to life, requires actors. Who are the actors? We are the actors, the people sitting around the table, eating, drinking, talking with one another. The table is the stage. And if you've ever really fallen in love with a certain play, then maybe you've seen more than one production of it. And if you've seen more than one production of a play, you'll have noticed that one production differs from the other. They're clearly the same story, but the different actors are bringing the story to life in different ways from one another. And if you have ever happened to be at a different Seder from the one that you were at the previous year, or perhaps the one you were at the previous night, you see how the actors, the people who you experience the Seder with, bring out different elements of the story. They bring themselves to the story. That, to me, is what's so powerful about the Haggadah. It's really a unique religious moment in our calendar. We don't have any other equivalent of it, where each family, each group of friends who spend Pesach together really bring themselves to it and make it into a unique experience.
Yeah, so in a sense, you're saying it's like a shared script that allows for families, communities, and this year also individuals to actually put together their own play. I love that. And I would add to what you're saying that there's also an element of improv involved, that the script needs to be, people need to go off script basically and ask questions and kind of bring up new ways of telling the story. And that's really what I love about the Haggadah and really the Seder, is that we actually have this sort of, like you said, script to help guide us. But there's all of these moments of questions and bringing up different practices and rituals, which are invitations for us to go off the script.
Right, right. It's a script which demands that each time it is acted out, it feels different
yes,
from the previous
yes,
time.
Yes, 100%. And also, it's a script that has a very specific trajectory. Because actually, we know in the Haggadah, which really tells over the story of how the Jews left Egypt, it's very interesting. It doesn't exactly tell over the story in the way that Shemot or the book of Exodus actually delineates it, but it's a narrative of how we remember what happened. And there's a general agreement amongst the rabbi that the story needs to start with Gnut. It needs to start in a negative way, like from the lowest place where the Israelites were, and end b'shevach, end with us talking about, you know, the high point, the place of deliverance, the promised land, in a sense, that they got to.
Do you mean what's commonly known as once upon a time, ... and they all lived happily ever after?
Yes, but once upon a time is dark and is gnut, and it's like bad news.
Once upon a time, there was a wicked, wicked king.
Exactly, exactly. And Rabbi Joe, so what are you know, this is the general trajectory of the Haggadah. What are the different rabbinic approaches towards this trajectory?
So the Mishnah in the tractate of the Talmud, which deals with Pesach, Pesachim, in the 10th chapter, it says exactly the line that you just said. How do you tell the story? Matril b'gnut u'mesayim b'shevach. You start with the disgrace, you start with the dark moment at the beginning, and you end with the... What is the bad thing? Now, you probably think that the bad thing is that we were slaves, that the story of Pesach is the story of our slavery and our liberation from that slavery. And indeed, this is the opinion of one of the great rabbis of the Talmud, Shmuel. Shmuel says, what is gnut? Gnut is avadim hayinu, that we were slaves. However, his colleague Rav had a different opinion. And he said, the gnut is mitchila ovdei avodat gelulim hayu avoteinu. That in the beginning, our ancestors were idolaters. That's the disgrace. And this machloket, this argument, only takes a few words in order to recount. But I have this feeling every time I return to it, that this is one of the definitional machlokot, one of the definitional arguments of Pesach. I think we find that you know, each sort of chag, each festival has got a different argument which captures it. And I feel that it's this for Pesach.
Right. And I think what makes this more compelling is that it's not only a machloket in the Gemara, it's not only a disagreement between the rabbis, but actually the Haggadah itself includes both opinions. In the Haggadah, it's not a one-dimensional telling of the story. It gives almost like different origin stories to asking the question, who are the Jewish people and how did we get here and how do we get to sit here today?
In a very explicit sense, exactly. Both passages are included as starting points.
Right. So we have the passage that retells the story really from slavery to freedom. And we have the passage that tells it from idolatry to service of God. So, you know, Rabbi Joe, I do agree with you. There's something deep here. So let's just start by trying to understand, what do these two approaches have in common and how are they different?
Well, here is what, let's start with the difference. The difference is in the chronology. When does this story begin? According to Shmuel, this story begins in Egypt with the enslavement of our ancestors. But according to Rav, it actually goes back a lot further. Our ancestors, we do not believe, were idolaters in Egypt. Nor was Yosef, who first went down to Egypt, nor was his father Yaakov, his grandfather Yitzhak, or his great-grandfather Avraham. But Yosef's great-grandfather, he was an idolater. In the famous image of the Midrash, he actually had an idol shop, which his son Avraham took a hammer to. That's where the story starts, according to Rav. So it's a much longer story. It goes back much further. In Shmuel's telling of the story, the slavery, the physical slavery, is the heart of the issue. For Rav, though, actually, what we might call the political element of it, the enslavement to the Egyptian state, is probably putting it too strongly to call it a detail, but it's not the main drama. The main drama is the religious trajectory of Israel from Terach to standing at Sinai.
Right. And in a sense, what's really interesting here is that there's two different starting points and also two different ending points. Like, I like to think of it almost as like two different conceptions of a promised land. Like, maybe if you asked Rav, he would say the most important thing is service to God and to reject idolatry. And Shmuel would say, no, the most important thing is to achieve political freedom and to not be, you know, politically enslaved to anybody else. What I actually find also interesting is that in both of them, they tell the story with God doing most of the action. God is the one who helps the Jews go from idolatry to service of God. God is the one who helps the Jews come from slavery to freedom. And there's something very profound there about the way that these rabbis are imagining the action of what it means to become free men and women.
I'm not 100% sure I agree with that, Michal. I think that the Shmuel trajectory of it's about physical enslavement and about the liberation from that, that really is one in which Israel themselves do not have so much agency. They are enslaved by others and they are redeemed by others. You know, Moshe and the plagues, the splitting of the sea, etc. They stand silent. But I think the religious narrative, which Rav proposes, that this is a story of moving from idolatry to faith, actually does require more on behalf of the Jewish people. They have to say, Na'aseh v'nishma, we accept the Torah, we will listen, we will do it.
Yeah, so I actually agree with you that descriptively, I see both trajectories as demanding action and agency by the Jewish people. But there's something very interesting about the words of the Haggadah. The words that they were chosen to describe this, right? Mitchila ovdei avodah zarah ayu avotenu, right? Our ancestors were idol worshippers. I have the Sephardic version, by the way. So if you have the Ashkenazi Haggadah and it's different, let me know. Ve'achshav kerbanu amakom le'avodato. And now Hashem brought us closer to God's worship. So it's almost like there's this deterministic arc of history in which the Jews have to go from one place to the next. But I also wanna say that I'm not sure that I see these two opinions as totally different from each other. I think that within Jewish tradition, there's very strong elements that speak about political freedom and political liberty as corresponding with service of God, right? That if you are oppressed by someone else, or if you are worshiping idols, it often or always involves some sort of social oppression at the same time.
I think it's pretty fundamental to our faith that the Jewish people stood at Har Sinai and that others did not. But if it's a story about slavery and freedom, then you understand how that becomes the template for so many more episodes throughout human history, where the Exodus narrative inspires so many future moments. How does that fit into how you just put it?
Well, I really like what you're saying. I think you're saying that in this machloket, and maybe also in the whole Haggadah and the story of Pesach, that we can find different layers. We can find this, on the one hand, very particularistic story, especially if you look at how we celebrate it. We're supposed to celebrate it within our families, with a Korban Pesach, with a Pesach sacrifice, with a lot of rituals that are particular only to people who are part of the Jewish covenant. And at the same time, the story of Yetziat Mitzrayim is one that is so universal and that has been used by so many liberation movements spanning different religions, different races, and just different moments in history. So there's something that I find very poignant about this, that this story can, on the one hand, feel so personal and particular, and at the same time have so many global and much broader reverberations.
And I think that what's so powerful is, as you said at the start, the Haggadah weaves these two together. The Haggadah does not take either Rav or Shmuel and tell the story according to that. Rather, it says, we're going to do both, and we're not actually going to separate the two of them out. And in some ways, I think this is emblematic of a much larger Jewish idea, which is that you're not allowed to just think of the world through a purely political lens. The political is also religious. But you're also not allowed to think of sort of an abstract religious sphere. Rather, that has to be real world. The religious is always connected to the world, and the world is always connected to a larger picture. I think probably this is the moment to move on to our second discussion. And that is, how is this year different from all other years? Manishtana Shana Hazeh. And it's pretty clear, I think, to everybody that this year's Seder is not, say, it's not going to be like next year's Seder, because this Pesach is taking place under the dark shadow of the coronavirus, which of course has to be said, by far the worst thing about it is the terrible cost in lives across the world. And after that, the huge disruption to so many lives. But in our own ways and in our own families, Jews across the world are finding this so hard because they're going to be separated from loved ones who they normally spend the Seder with. I feel this very personally. My mother was due to come out to us from London, but she's not going to be able to join us, and unfortunately she'll be by herself for a Seder. Read the Haggadah this year. What do you feel, Michal?
Oh, that's a big question that I think many of us are struggling with and trying to prepare and plan and ask ourselves what would it look like and feel like. And I do think that undoubtedly this year will look different than any other year. And it also will bring up new questions that we'll have to contend with and try to grapple with. And one important question is that I think in our tradition, in Jewish tradition, Jewish text, we are very comfortable talking about human enemies, right? Just think, for example, about the Haggadah, right? We have Paro. The way that I tell my three-year-old son Ness, it's like Min Paro, who says no, no, no. It's like this symbol of evil and wickedness. And then we have the Israelites who, with God's help, you know, achieve liberation and walk towards Sinai to cover both Shmuel and Rav. But our situation right now of dealing with this virus is so different. It's not necessarily this human tyrant that is oppressing us. So I wonder how much of the oppression in the Haggadah and in so many of our classical Jewish stories, how much can they inform us and help us at this moment, or are they too different for them to help us right now?
Right. Yeah, this I've been thinking on this so much. We're so used to thinking about human enemies, and Corona is a non-human enemy. Now, it is, of course, true that the Tanakh does present us frequently with plagues, with famines, with drought. This is something which is frequently a theme in Tanakh. It's interesting, though, that is not captured in the calendar. Right, our calendar doesn't think about famine. By contrast, our calendar does have multiple moments in which it thinks about human adversaries throughout the generations. Pesach, Purim, Tisha B'Av, all very different from one another, but all are responding to that essential Vehisha Amda Lavotenu, that though arose in every generation against us. Can our tradition give some sort of answer or some sort of orientation for this moment of Corona?
I think it's such a difficult and worthwhile, because it's difficult, right? Difficult and worthwhile question. I do think it's intriguing what you're saying, and I hadn't thought of this, that we don't have any holidays in which we celebrate our victory over, you know, some sort of plague or drought or something like that. At the same time, you know, classical Jewish sources, beginning with the Torah, do give theories and theologies which we moderns feel very uncomfortable with, in which the Torah talks about a lot of this sort of like natural disasters as kind of coming as divine punishment or retribution. So we could start talking philosophy. How do we read these passages? Can we read them? Do we read them literally? Do we read them figuratively? How do we approach the Torah as the word of God, while perhaps revisiting the meaning of this sort of descriptions? But I'm not sure what to make of that. If that classical theology is so difficult for our time, then how can we approach these moments in our tradition?
Perhaps one is just in a very simple sense for regular listeners of this podcast. You will recall that last week, when Michal and I were sharing some of ideas about Pesach, I mentioned this piece of the Sfat Emet, the great Rebbe of Gur, who has this idea that there is Yitziat Mitzrayim in every generation, that each of us are supposed to think not just of the historical Egypt, but of our own Egypt right now. And perhaps just in a very basic sense, this year we have something in common with previous generations who lived under despotic regimes, in that our Seder is not being said from a position of comfort. It's being said from a position of L'shana haba b'Yerushalayim, please God, let next year be more comfortable than this year. And it's true, the oppressor is not the Soviet regime, but the oppressor is something very, very real. And perhaps that it can be a statement of faith to hope that that passes.
Yeah, Rabbi Joe, I have two objections or two disagreements or differences with what you just said. The first one is that I'm actually a little bit hesitant and wary about comparing our situation today to that of certain historical moments in which Jews lived under tremendous oppressive conditions. Thank God, at least my acquaintances and my circles, and I'm not speaking for everybody, but thank God we have access to food, we have access to basic needs, we're taken care of. And I'm afraid that if we fully put ourselves in the shoes of our ancestors who were slaves in Egypt in this exact way, that we'll forget how much we have right now and how much we're obligated as privileged people to fight for others who are less oppressed, as opposed to thinking of ourselves as oppressed. So that's just like one question that I would love to that I would ask the Sfatemet, right? How do we feel like we have to move towards Geula, but without forgetting that there's a lot of other people who have less privilege than us, and maybe our responsibility is to help them move towards Geula?
I actually think that in some ways our condition this year provides the answer to that, in that the whole world, and that's like actually a true statement for once, is experiencing something in common that they haven't in the past. I think that we are able to have a concern for others that perhaps is difficult to have in a usual year where people are outside of our purview, are there across seas or here, really, whether it's in a different neighborhood to you or a different country for you, we are having a global experience of asking for our yitzia, for our liberation.
I wish I was, I wish I believed that fully. I do see a lot of the blessings and the heroes who are rising up and having this global consciousness and who are taking this moment to expand who they are. But I also, I think that this pandemic is also revealing a lot of our social problems. And I want to take this opportunity to say something to our question of like, how can we learn from our tradition, which talks usually about human enemies when confronting a non-human enemy like a virus? You know, I'm a sociologist, right? And part of what my training always teaches me or really taught me is that we can't only examine things from the perspective of nature. We also have to examine them from the perspective of the social structures that allow nature to develop in a certain way. So there's a brilliant book called Heat Wave by sociologist Eric Kleinenberg, in which he studies a heat wave that happened in Chicago in 1995. And the subtitle of his book is A Social Autopsy of a Natural Disaster. And the main thesis that he has there is that we do have these natural disasters like heat waves or like coronavirus or like a drought or all these other things that we can point to and say this is not something that was made by humans. But the way that these things will develop, the amount of lives that it will claim, will depend on human structures. It will depend on who our leadership is. It will depend on what kind of healthcare do we have. It will depend on whether we have access for resources for everybody. It depends on so many things that are absolutely up to us. So for me, Pesach is mamash significant to not allow ourselves this sort of fallacy to believe, oh, our ancestors had a human enemy in the shape of Paro, this human tyrant, and we don't. We actually need to right now, in my opinion, not only fight against the virus in a medical or biological way, but also to ask ourselves, how are we implicated as citizens of this society in establishing different structures that have allowed the virus to do certain damage and God forbid to continue its damage? And what's our responsibility as people, as descendants of slaves in Egypt, and as people who hold the memory of Pesach, to fight those social elements that are making this moment worse for others.
I think you're so right that this has to be a moment which spurs us to ask questions about how can we actually make our world better. But I'm going to push back on you on what you said with the following. Yes, you are a sociologist, but you're also a Rosh Kehillah. And in your Rosh Kehillah hat, Kisui Rosh, your role is not just to socially diagnose, but also to find religious meaning. And as we've also mentioned tonight, there is Shmuel, who says Avadim Hayinu, and it's about politics. But there's also Rav, who says Mitchila Avodes of the Avodazara Hayu Avoteinu. It's about the religious element. So feeling your social anger so justifiably, I still want to ask, for somebody who there's a political fire that burns in their belly that says, I want to use this corona moment in order to make the world a better place, what is our religious response? And perhaps one idea, and I don't know if I stand behind this, but it's worth thinking through, is that maybe the Pesach parallel for corona is not that corona is Pharaoh. That's a problematic parallel, as you've said. Perhaps that corona is the plagues. Now, of course, that's difficult because we sort of like the plagues in the Seder. The kids enjoy them. It is the downfall of our enemies. And obviously that doesn't apply across right now. But in a sense of just terror, that perhaps is something we can understand this year, which we might not have understood last year.
So I don't necessarily agree with the dichotomy that we have like religious responses and political responses, and that they're not actually deeply interconnected with each other. I think part of what it means to be a religious person and a religious leader is to ask ourselves both how do we pray and how do we protest, right? How do we learn Torah and how do we feed the hungry, as you not only teach but are doing on a daily basis and mobilizing. And I take extremely seriously the fact that what it means to be a religious person is to construct not only a positive theology, which means where is the space for God, but also a negative theology, which means where are the places where it's dangerous to blame God for things that we are responsible for and that we have to actually fix, that it's up to us. And I think the Haggadah does represent this. And I'll just mention two moments in which it brings this very almost paradoxical approach of looking at our human agency, but also, you know, God and God's role. We open our doors and we say Alach Ma'aniya. We say everybody who's hungry, come and eat. This means that we have learned from the story of Pesach that we have a human response to open our doors and that we are responsible to feed the hungry. That's what we learned from Pesach. We also end the Magid section with Halel. We turn to Hashem and we say, God, we are grateful to you for your overwhelming blessing, and we know we are nothing. We are nothing without everything you have given us in the past and continue to give us today. So I think we need to hold both and hold it tight, especially in this moment. You know, Rabbi Joe, I want to just, you know, as we're wrapping up, I would love to hear from you. You know, if there's an inspiring message, one of Chizuk that you're taking with you to the Seder, what would that be?
Well, I think it's quite right that we should finish with that, because that last section was wonderful, but it was pretty heavy. So yeah, let's share some of our favorite ideas. So it's a truism that Seder night is about the children. So that the children will ask is a phrase which sort of comes from it. The children sing Manishtana. We have the four sons, the four daughters, four different versions of children who arouse their curiosity. If perhaps the reverse is true, that the Seder isn't there in order for the children to learn, but rather the focus on the children and to be adults, to be able to think more like children. Children who, as thank God you and I, Michal, are both blessed to have small children, who are so filled with wonder, who have such astonishing creative abilities, and that adults who are so frequently stuck in their ways about how to think about things, on Saturday night they should be shaken out of that. I once read a beautiful piece by an old teacher of mine, Rav Eliakim Krumbein, who said that the She'eini Yodea Lishol, the child at the Seder who doesn't know how to ask a question, is not a 3-year-old or a 5-year-old. He's a person in their 40s who's got a well-paying job, who's got a family, but who just feels that he's got everything sorted out and is too terrified to ask any questions, because if he does, that would destabilize the apparatus that he has built for himself. Seder night teaches us to act like children, to ask questions about our world.
That's beautiful. So we're supposed to go into Pesach working to become more childlike.
I'd like to suggest, what have you got for me? Inspire me, Michal.
Well, you know, I was thinking, we started off by talking about Rav and Shmuel and asking what's the trajectory, right? What's the promised land? And I would actually like to suggest that the Agadah itself is a promised land. If you study the, you know, writings about oppressed people or people who are slaves, the ability to write your own history, to write your own story, is absolutely a mark of freedom, right? Being able to experience great challenges and then to write your memory of it, not only your memory of it, but what you choose to do because of that memory. Only free men and women can do that. And I am actually, like, Pesach makes me really proud, because I am proud to belong to a people that has this history of slavery and, you know, and going towards freedom, and that then decided to not only remember by sitting down every year and telling the story, but to remember it through action, opening our door to feed those who are hungry, like we said earlier, saying thank you to God, encouraging curiosity and asking questions from everybody around us, sitting together in family units, knowing that we must take care of the stranger because we were strangers in Egypt. There's something incredibly powerful and radical about the fact that we took our experience of slavery and we came up with this Agadah, this amazing, incredible night of storytelling to remind us who we were and who we're supposed to be. So my hope actually is that, you know, as coronavirus is really affecting us, is that we remind ourselves this message of freedom, that next year, God willing, we won't have coronavirus, but we will have our memory of it. And that memory will depend on each and every one of us and how we want it to shape us. And the question we should be asking ourselves this Seder is not only how is this night different, but how are we going to be different, right? Because of this night, what are the ethical teachings that we're going to take close to our heart, and how are we going to, God willing, bring a little bit more light into this somewhat broken world of us.
Thank you so much, Michal. On that note, I think it's time for us to close. This is the Downtown Drash. The Downtown Drash is a podcast which is a project of the Bronfman Center for Jewish Life at NYU, OUJLIC, and the Downtown Minyan. Thank you for listening to our conversation. We'd love to hear your feedback. Please do join us to learn Torah together every week.